meant at first. A foolish joke of the husband substituted the other. But the husband has been well punished since, and I have obtained reparation." Grimaud appeared in his turn, leading his master's horse. D'Artagnan and Athos came down, got into their saddles by the side of their companions, and they all four proceeded towards the quay. Athos on the horse for which he was indebted to his wife, Aramis on the horse for which he was indebted to his mistress, Porthos on the horse for which he was indebted to the attorney's wife, and D'Artagnan on the horse for which he was indebted only to his own good fortune, which is the best of all mistresses. The valets followed them. As Porthos had expected, the cavalcade produced a fine effect, and if Madame Coquenard had been in Porthos's path, and could have seen how well he looked upon his fine Spanish steed, she would hardly have regretted the bleeding operation that she had performed upon her husband's strongbox. Near the Louvre, the four friends met Monsieur de Tréville returning from Saint-Germain's. He stopped them to compliment them on their equipment, which drew around them in an instant a few hundred loafers. D'Artagnan took advantage of this circumstance to speak to Monsieur de Tréville about the great letter with the great red seal and ducal arms. It will be imagined that of the other letter he did not breathe a syllable. Monsieur de Tréville approved of the resolution they had formed, and assured him that if he should not be seen again on the next day, he would manage to find him out, wherever he might be. At that moment the clock of the Samaritan struck six. The four friends excused themselves on account of an engagement and set off. A short gallop took them to the Chaillot Road. The day was beginning to decline. Carriages were passing backwards and forward. D'Artagnan, supported by his friends at a little distance, looked eagerly into every carriage, but saw no face he knew. At length, after about a quarter of an hour's expectation, and as the twilight thickened around, a carriage, advancing at the utmost speed of the horses, was seen upon the Sèvres road. A presentiment announced to D'Artagnan that this carriage contained the individual who had made the appointment with him. The young man was himself astonished at the violent beating of his heart. Almost at the same instant, a woman's head was visible at the window, with two fingers on the lips, as if to enjoin silence or to send a kiss. D'Artagnan uttered a faint cry of joy. This woman, or rather this apparition, for the carriage passed away with the rapidity of a vision, was Madame Bonancieux. By an involuntary movement, and in spite of the caution he had received, D'Artagnan set his horse to a gallop, and in a few bounds was beside the carriage. But the window was hermetically closed. The vision was no longer there. D'Artagnan then remembered the warning. If you value your own life, and that of those who love you, remain motionless, as if you had seen nothing. He stopped, therefore, trembling not for himself, but for the poor woman, who had evidently exposed herself to no trifling peril by the appointment she had made. The carriage proceeded on its way, and, still advancing rapidly, soon entered Paris and disappeared. D'Artagnan had remained speechless on the same spot, knowing not what to think. If it were really Madame Bonancieux, and if she were returning to Paris, why this fugitive meeting? Why this passing interchange of glances? Why, this kiss committed to the winds? If, on the other hand, it were not really she, which was in fact very possible, for the insufficiency of light made error easy, might not this be the beginning of an attack prepared by the attraction of a woman for whom his love was known? The three companions gathered around him. They had all distinctly seen a woman's head at the window, but neither of them, except Athos, knew Madame Bonancieux by sight. Athos believed that it was really that lady whom they had seen, but having been less engrossed than D'Artagnan by that pretty face, he thought that he had seen a second head, and a manly one, at the back of the carriage. "If that is the case," said D'Artagnan, "they are undoubtedly conveying her from one prison to another. But what can they want to do with the poor creature, and how shall I ever rejoin her?" "My friend," said Athos gravely, "remember that the dead are the only ones whom we can never encounter again on earth. You know a story to that effect as well as I do, do you not? Now, if your mistress is not really dead, if it was actually her whom we saw just now, at one time or another you will meet with her again. And perhaps," added he, in those tones of misanthropy which were habitual to him, "perhaps more quickly even than you might have wished." It now struck 7:30. The carriage had been 20 minutes beyond the appointed time. His friends reminded D'Artagnan that there was another visit to pay, which, however, it was yet possible for him to decline. But D'Artagnan was, at the same time, both obstinate and curious. He had, in his own mind, determined to go to the cardinal's palace, and to know what his eminence had to say to him. Nothing could make him change his resolution. They reached the Rue Saint-Honoré and the Place du Palais Cardinal, where they found the 12 musketeers walking about, whilst they awaited their companions. Then, for the first time, was the business they had met for communicated to these brave allies. D'Artagnan was well known to the honourable company of King's musketeers, amongst whom, it was further understood, he would one day take his place. He was therefore regarded as a comrade by anticipation. It resulted from this that everyone willingly engaged in the affair to which he had been invited, and they had, moreover, the probability of doing an ill turn to the cardinal or his people, and for such expeditions these worthy gentlemen were always well prepared. Athos divided them into three parties. Of one he took the command himself, the second he gave to Aramis, and the third to Porthos, and then each party placed itself in ambush opposite an entrance of the palace. D'Artagnan, on his part, boldly entered by the principal gate. Although he felt himself strongly supported, the young man did not ascend the grand staircase without uneasiness. His conduct towards her ladyship had some slight resemblance to a treachery, and he suspected that there were political relations between this woman and the cardinal. Moreover, De Wardes, whom he had handled so roughly, was a faithful follower of his eminence, and D'Artagnan well knew that, while the cardinal was a terror to his enemies, he was also constant in his attachment to his friends. "If De Wardes has related all our interview to his eminence, of which there can be no doubt, and if he has recognized me, which is probable, I may consider myself almost a condemned man," thought D'Artagnan, shaking his head. "But why should he have waited till today? It is clear enough her ladyship has made complaints against me, with all that hypocritical sorrow which renders her so interesting, and this last crime has made the vase run over. Fortunately," added he, "my good friends are below, and they will not let me be carried off without a conflict. And yet Monsieur de Tréville's company of musketeers alone cannot carry on a war against the cardinal, who disposes of the forces of all France, and before whom the queen has no power and the king no will. D'Artagnan, my friend, thou art brave, thou art prudent, thou hast excellent qualities, but women will destroy thee." He had come to this sad conclusion just as he entered the antechamber. He gave his letter to the officer on duty, who showed him into the waiting room, and himself proceeded into the interior of the palace. In this room were 5 or 6 of His Excellency's guards, who, recognizing D'Artagnan, and knowing that it was he who had wounded Jussac, looked at him with a singular smile. This smile seemed to D'Artagnan a bad omen. But as our Gascon was not easily intimidated, or rather, thanks to the abundant pride natural to men of his province, did not easily betray what was passing in his mind when what was passing there resembled fears, he stood boldly before the gentlemen of the guards, and waited, with his hand upon his hip, in an attitude not ungraceful. The officer returned, and made a sign to D'Artagnan to follow him. It seemed to the young man that, as he left the room, the guards began to whisper to each other. He went along a corridor, passed through a large saloon, entered a library, and found himself before a man who was seated at a desk, writing. The officer introduced him, and retired without uttering a word. D'Artagnan remained standing and examined this man. At first D'Artagnan thought that he was in the presence of a judge who was examining his papers, but he soon saw that the man at the desk was writing, or rather correcting, lines of an unequal length, and was scanning the words upon his fingers. D'Artagnan found that he was in the presence of a poet. At the expiration of a minute, the poet closed his manuscript, on the back of which was written, "Mirame, a tragedy in 5 acts." He raised his head, and D'Artagnan recognized the cardinal. 40. A Terrible Vision. Richelieu rested his elbow on his manuscript, and his cheek on his hand, and looked at D'Artagnan for an instant. No one had an eye more profoundly penetrating than the cardinal, and the young man felt his gaze running through his veins like a fever. Nevertheless, he kept a good countenance, holding his hat in his hand, and waiting His Eminence's pleasure, without too much pride, but at the same time without too much humility. "Sir," said the cardinal, "are you one D'Artagnan of Bearn?"
"Yes, my lord."
"There are several branches of the D'Artagnans in Tarbes, and in its neighbourhood. To which of them do you belong?"
"I am the son of him who fought in the religious wars with the great King Henry, the father of His Gracious Majesty."
"That is it. It is you who set out from your native place about 7 or 8 months ago to come and seek your fortune in the capital?"
"Yes, my lord."
"You came by Meung, where something happened to you. I do not exactly know what, but something?"
"My lord," said D'Artagnan, "this is what happened."
"Unnecessary, quite unnecessary," interrupted the cardinal, with a smile which indicated that he knew the story quite as well as he who wished to narrate it. "You were recommended to Monsieur de Tréville, were you not?"
"Yes, my lord, but in that unlucky affair at Meung, the letter of introduction was lost," resumed His Eminence.
"Yes, I know that. But Monsieur de Tréville is a skilful physiognomist who knows men at the first sight, and he has placed you in the company of his brother-in-law, Monsieur des Essarts, leaving you to hope that some day or other you will be enrolled in the musketeers."
"Your lordship is perfectly correct."
"Since that time, many things have happened to you. You walked behind the Chartreux one day when you had much better have been elsewhere. Then you made a journey to the waters of Forges with your friends. They stopped upon the road, but you continued your journey. That was natural enough. You had business in England."
"My lord," said D'Artagnan, quite confounded,
"I went to hunt at Windsor, or somewhere else. That is no business of anybody's. I know it, because it is my duty to know everything. On your return, you were received by an august person, and I see with pleasure that you have kept the souvenir which she gave you." D'Artagnan put his hand on the diamond which the queen had given him, and quickly turned the stone inwards, but it was too late. "On the next day, you were waited upon by Cavois," continued the cardinal. "He came to beg you to come to the palace, but you did not return that visit, and in that you were wrong."
"My lord, because I feared that I had incurred your eminence's displeasure."
"And why so, sir? Because you had performed the orders of your superiors with more intelligence and courage than another could have done? Incur my displeasure when you merited praise? It is those who do not obey that I punish, and not those who, like you, obey too well. And to prove it, recall the date of the day on which I sent for you to come to see me, and seek in your memory what happened on that very night."
It was the evening on which Madame Bonancieux was carried off. D'Artagnan shuddered, and he remembered that half an hour before this present moment the poor woman had passed before him, no doubt again borne away by the same power which had directed that abduction.
"At last," continued the cardinal, "as I had heard nothing of you for some time, I wished to know what you were doing. Besides, you certainly owe me some thanks. You have yourself remarked what consideration has been always shown towards you."
D'Artagnan bowed respectfully.
"That," continued the cardinal, "proceeded not only from a sentiment of natural justice, but also from a plan that I had traced respecting you."
D'Artagnan was more and more astonished.
"It was my desire," continued the cardinal, "to explain this plan to you on the day that you received my first invitation, but you did not come. Fortunately, nothing has been lost by the delay, and today you shall hear the explanation. Sit down, then, before me, Monsieur D'Artagnan. You are gentleman enough not to be kept standing whilst you listen."
The cardinal pointed out a chair to the young man, who was so astonished at what was taking place that he waited, before he obeyed, for a second intimation from his interlocutor.
"You are brave, Monsieur D'Artagnan," resumed His Eminence, "and you are prudent, which is far better.
I love men of head and heart. Do not be alarmed, he added, smiling. By men of heart I mean courageous men. But young as you are, and only on the threshold of the world, your enemies are very powerful. If you do not take care, they will destroy you.
Alas, my lord, replied the young man, they will undoubtedly accomplish it very easily, for they are strong and well supported, whilst I stand alone.
Yes, that is true. But alone as you are, you have already done much, and will, I doubt not, do still more. Yet you have, I believe, need of a guide in the adventurous career you have undertaken, since, if I am not deceived, you have come to Paris with the ambitious intention of making a fortune.
I am at the age of foolish hopes, my lord, said D'Artagnan.
No hopes are foolish, except for blockheads, sir, and you are a man of ability. Come, what would you say to an ensigncy in my guards, and a company at the end of the campaign?
Ah, my lord!
You accept it, do you not?
My lord, replied D'Artagnan with an embarrassed air.
What? Do you decline it? Exclaimed the cardinal, with a look of astonishment.
I am in His Majesty's guards, my lord, and I have no cause to be discontented.
But it seems to me, said His Eminence, that my guards are also His Majesty's guards, and that whosoever serves in a French regiment serves the king.
My lord, your Eminence has misunderstood my words.
You want a pretext, do you not?
I understand.
Very well. This pretext, here it is. Promotion, the opening of a campaign, the opportunity which I offer you, these will be sufficient for the world. For yourself, the necessity of sure protection. For it is as well for you to know, Monsieur D'Artagnan, that I have received serious complaints against you. You do not consecrate your nights and days exclusively to the service of the king.
D'Artagnan blushed.
Moreover, added the cardinal, laying his hand on a roll of papers, I have here a whole bundle of particulars about you. But before reading them, I wish to talk with you. I know that you are a man of resolution, and your services, if well directed, instead of leading you to evil, might benefit you greatly. Come, reflect and make up your mind.
Your goodness confounds me, my lord, replied D'Artagnan. And I discover in your Eminence a greatness of soul which makes me insignificant as the crawling worm. But in fact, since your Eminence permits me to speak frankly...
D'Artagnan stopped.
Yes, speak.
Well then, I must inform your Eminence that all my friends are amongst the musketeers and the king's guards, and that all my enemies, by some inconceivable fatality, are in the service of your Eminence. On this account, I should be unwelcome here and despised there, if I accepted what your Eminence is good enough to offer.
And can you already have the proud idea that I do not offer you as much as you deserve, sir?
Inquired the cardinal with a smile of scorn.
My lord, your Eminence is 100 times too good to me, and on the contrary, I do not think that I have yet done enough to merit your kindness. The siege of La Rochelle is about to commence, my lord. I shall serve under your Eminence's own eyes, and if I shall have the good fortune to conduct myself in such a manner at the siege as to merit your approbation, it will be well. After that, I shall at least have to my credit some action of sufficient brilliancy to justify the protection with which your Eminence may condescend to honour me. Everything should be effected in an appropriate time. Perhaps hereafter I may have the right to give myself away. At present I should be supposed to sell myself.
That is to say, you refuse to serve me, sir, said the cardinal in a tone of anger, through which, however, might be traced a sentiment of esteem.
Remain in freedom, then, and still preserve your hatreds and your sympathies.
My lord, well, well, continued the cardinal, I am not offended with you, but you must understand, it is quite enough to protect and recompense one's friends. One owes nothing to one's enemies. And yet I will give you one piece of advice. Take care of yourself, Monsieur D'Artagnan. for from the moment that I shall have withdrawn my hand from you, I would not give one farthing for your life."
"I will do my best, my lord," replied the Gascon, with modest confidence.
"And hereafter, at the moment that any misfortune has befallen you, remember," said Richelieu with some feeling, "that it is I who have sought you, and that I have done what I could to avert from you that misfortune."
"Let what may happen," said D'Artagnan, bowing, with his hand upon his breast, "I shall retain a sentiment of eternal gratitude, Your Eminence, for what you are doing for me at the present time."
"Well, then, Monsieur D'Artagnan, as you say, we shall see each other again after the campaign. I shall keep my eyes upon you, for I shall be there," continued the cardinal, pointing to a magnificent suit of armor which he was to wear. "And on our return we will decide on our arrangement."
"Ah, my lord," exclaimed D'Artagnan, "spare me the weight of your displeasure. Remain neutral, my lord, if you find that I behave gallantly."
"Young man," said Richelieu, "if I can once more say to you what I have said today, I promise you that I will say it." This last expression of Richelieu involved a terrible doubt. It alarmed D'Artagnan more than a threat would have done, for it was a warning. It implied that the cardinal was endeavoring to shield him from some impending evil. He opened his lips to answer, but with a haughty gesture the cardinal dismissed him. D'Artagnan left the room, but at the door his heart almost failed him, and he was strongly tempted to return. Yet the serious and severe countenance of Athos arose before his mind. If he agreed to what the cardinal proposed, Athos would no longer offer him his hand. Athos would disown him. It was this fear that determined him. So powerful is the influence of a truly noble character over all that approaches it. D'Artagnan went down by the same staircase that he had ascended, and found, before the door, Athos and the four musketeers who were awaiting him, and were beginning to be anxious about him. With one word he reassured them, and Planchet ran to the other posts to announce that any further guard was unnecessary, as his master had returned, safe and sound, out of the cardinal's palace. When they were housed at Athos's, Aramis and Porthos inquired about the object of this singular interview. But D'Artagnan merely told them that Richelieu had sent for him to offer him an ensign's commission in the guards, and that he had refused it. "And you were right," exclaimed Aramis and Porthos with one voice. Athos fell into a profound reverie and said nothing. But when he was alone with D'Artagnan, he said, "You have done as you ought, although perhaps you were imprudent." D'Artagnan sighed, for this voice responded to a secret whisper of his own soul, which announced that great misfortunes were preparing for him. The next day was occupied in preparations for departure. D'Artagnan went to take leave of Monsieur de Tréville. At this time it was still believed that the separation of the guards and musketeers would be but momentary, the king holding his parliament that very day, and proposing to set out on the next. Monsieur de Tréville therefore only asked D'Artagnan whether he wanted anything of him, but D'Artagnan replied that he had all he should need. In the evening, all the comrades of Monsieur de Tréville's and Monsieur des Essarts' companies, who had become attached to one another, met together. They were about to part, to meet again, when and if it should please God to let them. The night was, therefore, as may be supposed, a very boisterous one, for on such occasions nothing but extreme pleasure can drive away extreme care. The next day, at the first sound of the trumpets, the friends separated. The musketeers hastened to Monsieur de Tréville's hotel, and the guards to that of Monsieur des Essarts. Each captain then led his company to the Louvre, where the king reviewed them. His Majesty was sad, and seemed in ill health, which detracted somewhat from his usual dignified appearance. In fact, the evening before, a fever had attracted him, even whilst he was holding a court of judicature amidst the Parliament. But he was not the less determined to set out in the evening, and in spite of all their presentations which had been made to him, he would hold this review, hoping, by the first vigorous opposition, to overpower the malady that had assailed him. The review being ended, the guards alone began their march, the musketeers being to set out only with the king, a delay which gave Porthos an opportunity of displaying his superb equipage in the Rue aux Ours. The attorney's wife saw him passing by, in his new uniform and on his splendid horse. But she loved Porthos too well to let him leave her thus, so she beckoned to him to dismount and enter. Porthos was magnificent. His spurs rattled, his cuirass beamed, and his sword smote dashingly against his legs. The clerks had no disposition to laugh this time. The musketeer looked too much like one who would soon slit their ears. The visitor was introduced to Maître Coquenard, whose little grey eyes glistened with rage when he beheld his pretended cousin so showily adorned. Nevertheless, he had one source of inward consolation. It was everywhere reported that the campaign would be a rough one, and he gently hoped, at the bottom of his heart, that Porthos might be one of the slain. Porthos presented his compliments to Maître Coquenard and took his leave. The attorney wished him all sorts of prosperity. As to Madame Coquenard, she was unable to restrain her tears, but no evil thoughts could be suggested by her grief. She was known to be strongly attached to her relations, on whose account she had always had the bitterest contentions with her husband. Whilst the attorney's wife was able to follow her handsome cousin with her eyes, she waved a handkerchief and leaned from the window as though she was about to precipitate herself into the street. Porthos received all these indications of tenderness like a man hardened to such demonstrations, but as he turned the corner of the street, he raised his hat and waved it in token of adieu. Aramis, on his part, wrote a long letter. To whom? None knew. In the next room, Kitty, who was to set off that very evening for Tours, was waiting for this mysterious epistle. Athos drank, sip by sip, the last bottle of his Spanish wine. In the meantime, D'Artagnan was marching with his company. In passing through the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, he turned and looked gaily at the Bastille, which he had at least as yet escaped. As he looked only at the Bastille, he did not see my lady, who, mounted on a dun horse, pointed him out with her finger to two ill-looking men, who immediately approached the ranks to reconnoitre him. To an interrogation which they addressed to the lady by a look, she answered by a sign that it was really he. Then, certain that there could be no mistake in the execution of her orders, she spurred her horse and disappeared. The two men followed the company, and at the end of the Faubourg Saint-Antoine they mounted two horses, which a servant out of livery was holding in readiness for them. 41. The Siege of La Rochelle. The Siege of La Rochelle was one of the greatest events of the reign of Louis XIII. The political views of the cardinal, when he undertook the siege, were extensive. Of the important cities which had been given by Henry IV to the Huguenots as places of safety, La Rochelle alone remained. The cardinal wished to destroy this last bulwark of Calvinism. La Rochelle, which had derived additional importance from the ruin of the other Calvinistic towns, was, besides, the last port which remained open to the English in the Kingdom of France, and, by closing it to England, our eternal enemy, the cardinal would end the work of Joan of Arc and of the Duke of Guise. Thus it was that Bassompierre, who was at the same time both Protestant and Catholic, Protestant from conviction and Catholic as commander of the Order of Saint-Esprit, Bassompierre, who was a German by birth and a Frenchman at heart, Bassompierre, who had a particular command at the siege of La Rochelle, said, on charging at the head of many other Protestant noblemen like himself, "You will see, gentlemen, that we shall be fools enough to take La Rochelle." And Bassompierre was right. The cannonades of the Isle of Ré were a prelude to the dragonades of the Cévennes. The taking of La Rochelle was the preface to the Edict of Nantes. But by the side of these general views of the levelling and simplifying minister, which belong to history, the chronicler is obliged to dwell upon the petty objects of the lover and the jealous rival. Richelieu, as everyone knows, had been enamoured of the queen. Had this love a purely political aim, or was it one of those profound passions with which Anne of Austria inspired those who were around her? This is what we cannot satisfactorily decide. Yet, at all events, it has been seen, by the circumstances which have been detailed in this history, that Buckingham had gained a superiority over him in two or three points, and that, especially in the affair of the diamond studs, thanks to the devotion of the three musketeers and the courage of D'Artagnan, he had most cruelly befooled him. It was Richelieu's object, therefore, not merely to rid France of an enemy, but to revenge himself on a rival. The revenge ought, too, to be great and signal, and completely worthy of the man who held in his hand, as a weapon, the forces of a whole realm. Richelieu knew that in fighting against England he was fighting against Buckingham, that in triumphing over England he should triumph over Buckingham, and lastly, that in humiliating England in the eyes of Europe he should humiliate Buckingham in the eyes of the Queen. On his part, Buckingham, whilst he was putting the honour of England prominently forward as his motive, was impelled by interests absolutely similar to those of the Cardinal. Buckingham also pursued a private revenge. Under no pretext had Buckingham been able to enter France as an ambassador, and he wished, therefore, to enter it as a conqueror. It follows from this that the true stake in this game which two powerful kingdoms were playing for the pleasure of two amorous men was nothing more than a glance from the eye of Anne of Austria. The Duke of Buckingham had gained the first advantage, arriving unexpectedly before the Isle of Ré, with 90 vessels and 20,000 men. He had surprised the Count de Thoiras, who was the king's commander in that isle, and, after a bloody contest, had accomplished a disembarkation. Let us record, by the way, that the Baron de Chantal fell in this combat, leaving an orphan daughter, a little girl, 18 months old. This little girl was afterwards Madame de Sévigné. The Count de Thoiras retreated into the citadel of Saint-Martin with his garrison, and threw 100 men into a small fort, which was called the Port of La Prée. This event had hastened the decision of the Cardinal, and, until he and the King could go and take the command of the siege of La Rochelle, which was resolved on, he had sent His Majesty's brother forward to direct the first operations, and had made all the troops of which he could dispose march towards the theatre of war. It was to this detachment of the army, which was sent forward as a vanguard, that our friend D'Artagnan belonged. The King, as we have said, was to follow when his court of justice had been held. On rising from this sitting, on the 28th of June, he had found himself seized with fever. He had, nonetheless, persisted in setting out, but getting worse, he had been obliged to stop at Villeroy. Now, where the King had stopped, there also stopped the musketeers. Hence it followed that D'Artagnan, who was only in the guards, found himself separated, for a time at least, from his good friends Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. This separation, which was only annoying to him, would certainly have become a source of serious anxiety had he been able to discern by what unsuspected dangers he was surrounded. Nevertheless, he arrived without mishap at the camp before La Rochelle. Everything was at present in the same state. The Duke of Buckingham and the English, in possession of the Isle of Ré, continued to besiege, but without success, the fort of La Prée and the citadel of Saint-Martin. And the hostilities with La Rochelle had commenced 2 or 3 days before, about a battery which the Duc d'Angoulême had just constructed near the city. The guards, under Monsieur des Essarts, were stationed at the Minimes. But we know that D'Artagnan, engrossed by the ambition of becoming a musketeer, had formed but few intimacies with his comrades, and found himself therefore isolated and abandoned to his own reflections. And these reflections were not cheerful. During the year that he had been in Paris, he had engaged himself in public affairs, and consequently his own private affairs, either of love or fortune, had made no great advances. As to love, the only woman for whom he had a sincere affection was Madame Bonancieux, and Madame Bonancieux had disappeared, nor could he yet discover what had become of her. As to fortune, he, a mere insect, had made an enemy of the Cardinal, that is to say, of a man before whom the nobles of the kingdom trembled, and even the king himself. That man had power to crush him, and yet he had abstained. To a mind as clear-sighted as that of D'Artagnan, this forbearance was a dawn which gave promise of a happier futurity. Then he had made himself another enemy, less to be dreaded, as he thought, but one whom he felt instinctively was not to be despised. That enemy was her ladyship. In exchange for all this, he had the protection and goodwill of the Queen, but Her Majesty's goodwill was, in the circumstances of the times, only an additional course of persecution, and her protection, it is known, protected very badly, witness Chalais and Madame Bonancieux. So that what he had most manifestly gained in all this was the diamond, worth 5,000 or 6,000 francs, which he wore upon his finger. And even this diamond, supposing that he must preserve it, to remind the Queen at some future day of her gratitude, had not, in the meantime, since he could not dispose of it, any greater value than the pebbles that he trampled beneath his feet. We say the pebbles that he trampled beneath his feet, for D'Artagnan made these reflections whilst he was walking alone in a pretty little path which led from the camp to an adjoining village. But these reflections had led him further than he intended, and the day was beginning to decline when, by the last ray of the setting sun, he seemed to perceive the barrel of a musket glittering behind a hedge. D'Artagnan had a quick eye and a ready wit. He comprehended that the musket had not come there of itself, and that he who held it was not concealed behind a hedge with any very amicable intentions. He determined, therefore, to gain the open country. But on the other side of the road, behind a rock, he perceived the muzzle of a second musket. It was evidently an ambuscade. The young man gave a glance at the first musket, and beheld with some anxiety that it was aiming in his direction. But as soon as he saw the orifice of the barrel motionless, he threw himself upon his face. At that instant the shot was fired, and he heard the whistling of a ball as it passed above his head. There was no time to lose. D'Artagnan raised himself up with a bound, and at the same moment the bullet of the second musket scattered the stones in the very part of the path where he had thrown himself down. D'Artagnan was not one of those foolishly brave men who seek a ridiculous death in order to have it said of them that they never retreated a step. Besides, courage could do nothing here. He had fallen into an ambuscade. "If there is a third shot," said he to himself, "I am a dead man." He immediately scampered towards the camp, with all the swiftness of his countrymen who are so famous for their activity. But, fast as was his course, the one who had fired first, having had time to reload his gun, made another shot at him, so well directed this time that the ball passed through his hat and drove it 10 paces before him. As D'Artagnan had no other hat, he picked it up as he ran, and reaching his lodging, pale and out of breath, he sat down without speaking to anyone, and began to reflect. This event might have 3 causes. The first, and most natural, was that it might be an ambuscade from La Rochelle, whose citizens would not have been sorry to kill one of His Majesty's guards, as it would make one enemy the less, and that enemy might have a well-filled purse in his pocket. D'Artagnan took his hat, examined the hole that the ball had made, and shook his head. The bullet did not belong to a musket, but to an arquebus. The precision of the aim had already made him think that it was fired by a civilian weapon, so it was not a military ambuscade, since the ball was not of that caliber. It might be a kind memorial of the cardinal. It may be remembered that, at the very moment when, thanks to the blessed beam of sunshine, he had perceived the gun-barrel, he was marvelling at the leniency His Eminence had shown towards him. But D'Artagnan shook his head with an air of doubt. The cardinal seldom had recourse to such means, towards people whom a movement of his hand might crush. It might be her ladyship's revenge. This conjecture was more reasonable. He tried in vain to recall either the features or the dress of the assassins, but he had hurried away too rapidly to have leisure to remark them. "Ah, my poor friends," muttered D'Artagnan, "where are you? Alas, how much I miss you!" D'Artagnan passed a very bad night. 3 or 4 times he awoke with a start, fancying that a man approached his bed to stab him. Yet the day dawned without any accident having occurred during the darkness. But D'Artagnan suspected that what is deferred is not therefore lost. He remained in his quarters throughout the whole day, and gave, as an excuse to himself, the dullness of the weather. At 9 o'clock on the next morning they beat to arms. The Duke of Orléans was visiting the pickets. The guards mustered, and D'Artagnan took his place amidst his comrades. His Royal Highness passed in front of the line, and then all the superior officers approached to pay their respects to him. Monsieur des Essarts, the captain of the guards, went with the others. After a short time, D'Artagnan thought he perceived Monsieur des Essarts making a sign to him to draw near. He waited for another gesture, fearing that he might have been mistaken, but on its being repeated, he left the ranks and advanced to receive the order.
"His Royal Highness is about to ask for volunteers for a dangerous expedition, which will be honorable to those who perform it, and I made you a sign that you might hold yourself in readiness."
"Thank you, Captain," replied D'Artagnan, who required nothing better than to distinguish himself before the eyes of the lieutenant-general. The Rochellois had, in fact, made a sortie during the night, and recaptured a bastion which the royal army had invested 2 days before. The idea was to push a forlorn hope so forward as to be able to discover in what manner the enemy guarded this bastion. After a few minutes, His Royal Highness raised his voice and said,
"I want 3 or 4 volunteers for this expedition, led by a man who can be depended upon." "As for your trustworthy man, here he is," said Monsieur des Essarts, pointing to D'Artagnan. "And as for the 4 or 5 volunteers, your Royal Highness has only to make your wishes known, and the men will not be wanting." 4 men who will volunteer to come and be killed with me," cried D'Artagnan, raising his sword.
2 of his companions in the guards rushed towards him instantaneously, and 2 other soldiers having joined them, the number was complete. D'Artagnan therefore rejected all others to avoid injustice to those who had the prior claim. It was not known whether the Rochellois, after having taken the bastion, had evacuated it, or placed a garrison in it. It was therefore necessary to examine the spot from a point sufficiently near to ascertain this point. D'Artagnan went off with his 4 companions in the line of the trench. The 2 guards marched by his side, and the 2 soldiers in the rear. Sheltering themselves in this manner by the rampart, they arrived within 100 paces of the bastion, and on turning round at that moment, D'Artagnan perceived that the 2 soldiers had disappeared. Believing them to have remained behind from fear, he continued to advance. At the turn of the counterscarp, they found themselves about 60 yards from the bastion, but they saw no one, and the bastion seemed evacuated. The 3 volunteers deliberated whether they should advance farther, when suddenly a circle of smoke appeared, and 12 balls whistled around D'Artagnan and his companions. They knew now what they had come to learn. The bastion was guarded. A longer delay, therefore, in so dangerous a place would have been only an unnecessary imprudence. So D'Artagnan and the 2 guards turned their backs and began a rapid retreat. On reaching the angle of the trench, which would serve as a rampart to them, one of the guards fell with a ball through his chest, whilst the other, who was safe and sound, made the best of his way to the camp. D'Artagnan would not thus abandon a companion, and leaned over him to lift him up, and aid him to regain the lines. But at that very moment, 2 shots were fired. 1 ball shattered the head of the man who was already wounded, and the other was flattened against a rock after having passed within 2 inches of D'Artagnan's body. The young man turned very quickly, for this attack could not come from the bastion, which was hidden by the angle of the trench. The remembrance of the 2 soldiers who had abandoned him occurred to his mind, and suggested to him his assassins of the previous evening. He resolved on this occasion to find out what it meant, and fell, therefore, upon the body of his comrade, as though he had been dead. He immediately saw that 2 heads were raised above an abandoned breastwork, which was about 30 yards from him. They were those of the 2 soldiers. D'Artagnan was not mistaken. These men had remained behind solely for the purpose of assassinating him, hoping that the death of the young man would be imputed to the attack of the enemy.
This is the end of disc number 13. Please insert disc number 14. This is disc number 14.
D'Artagnan was not mistaken. These men had remained behind solely for the purpose of assassinating him, hoping that the death of the young man would be imputed to the attack of the enemy. But as he might be only wounded and might denounce their crime, they drew near to complete their work. Happily, deceived by the sight of D'Artagnan's position, they neglected to reload their muskets. When they were about 3 paces from him, D'Artagnan, who had taken especial care, in falling, not to relinquish his sword, suddenly arose and sprang upon them. The assassins were well aware that if they fled towards the camp without having killed their man, they should be accused by him, and therefore their first impulse was to pass over to the enemy. One of them took his gun by the barrel and made use of it as a club. He dealt a terrible blow at D'Artagnan, who avoided it by jumping aside. By this movement, however, D'Artagnan opened a passage to the bandit, who immediately sprang forth towards the bastion. But as the Rochellois who guarded it were ignorant of his intentions in advancing, they fired upon him, and he fell, with his shoulder broken by a ball. In the meantime, D'Artagnan threw himself on the 2nd soldier with his sword. The struggle was not long. This wretch had only his discharged fusée to defend himself with. The sword of the guardsman glided along the barrel of this useless weapon and passed through the assassin's thigh. As soon as he had fallen, D'Artagnan applied the point of his weapon to his throat.
"Oh, do not kill me!" exclaimed the bandit. "Pardon, sir! Sir, and I will confess everything!"
"Is it worth my while to grant you your life for your secret?" demanded the young man.
"Yes, if you consider life of any value to a man of 22 years of age, who, being as handsome and as brave as you are, may accomplish anything!"
"Wretch!" cried D'Artagnan. "Come, speak quickly! Who engaged you to assassinate me?"
"A woman whom I do not know, but who was called my lady."
"But if you do not know this woman, how came you to know her name?"
"My comrade knew her, and called her so. It was with him that she arranged the affair, not with me. He has a letter from this person now in his pocket, which would be of great importance to you, according to what I heard him say."
"But how came you to be his partner in this ambuscade?"
"He proposed to me to join him in it, and I agreed."
"And how much has she paid you for this pretty expedition?"
"100 louis."
"Well, upon my word," said the young man, laughing, "she thinks me of some value. 100 louis! It is quite a fortune for two wretches like you. I can well understand that you would accept it, and so I pardon you, but on one condition."
"What is that?"
said the soldier, uneasy at discovering that all was not yet ended.
"That you go and get me the letter out of your companion's pocket."
"But,"
exclaimed the bandit,
"that is only another way of killing me. How can you ask me to go for the letter under the very fire of the bastion?"
"But you must make up your mind to go for it, or I swear that you shall directly die by my hand."
"Mercy, sir, mercy! In the name of that young lady whom you love, and whom perhaps you imagine dead, but who is not so!"
screamed the bandit, throwing himself upon his knees and supporting himself on his hand, for he was beginning to lose his strength along with his blood.
"And how do you know that there is a young lady whom I love, and that I have believed her to be dead?" demanded D'Artagnan.
"By that letter in my comrade's pocket!"
"You see, then, that I must have that letter," said D'Artagnan. "So let us have no longer delay, no more hesitation, or whatever may be my repugnance to bathe my sword a second time in the blood of such a wretch as you are, I swear to you, on the word of an honorable man!"
At these words, D'Artagnan made such a threatening gesture that the wounded man arose.
"Stop! Stop!"
exclaimed he, recovering courage through the very force of fear.
"I will go! I will go!"
D'Artagnan took the soldier's arquebus, made him walk before him, and urged him at the same time towards his companion by pricking him in the loins with the point of his sword. It was a fearful spectacle to witness this unhappy being leaving a long track of blood upon the path he took, growing pale from the approach of death, and yet striving to drag himself without being seen to the body of his accomplice, which was stretched out at a distance of 20 paces. Terror was so depicted on his countenance, which was covered with an icy sweat, that D'Artagnan both pitied and despised him.
"Come," said he, "I will show you the difference between a man of courage and a coward like you. Wait where you are, I will go."
And with an active step, and his eye upon the bastion, observing the proceedings of the enemy, and availing himself of every inequality of ground, he managed to advance as far as the second soldier. There were two methods of accomplishing his purpose, either to search him where he was, or to carry him away, making a buckler of his body, and then to search him at leisure in the trench. D'Artagnan preferred the second plan, and had thrown the body of the assassin on his shoulders just at the very moment that the enemy fired. A slight tremor, a final cry, a shudder of agony, proved to D'Artagnan that he who had sought to assassinate him had now saved his life. D'Artagnan reached the trench, and threw the body by the side of the wounded man, who was quite as pale as the dead one. He then began to take an inventory. There was a leather pocketbook, a purse which evidently contained a part of the sum which the banditti had received, and a dice-box and dice, and these composed the inheritance of the dead man. He left the dice-box and dice where they had fallen, threw the purse to the wounded man, and eagerly opened the pocketbook. Amongst several unimportant papers, he found the following letter. It was that for which he had gone to search at the hazard of his life. "Since you have lost the track of that woman, and she is now in safety at the convent, which you never ought to have allowed her to reach, take care at any rate not to miss the man. Otherwise you know that I have a long arm, and you shall pay dearly for the 100 louis which you have had of mine." There was no signature. Nevertheless, it was evident that the letter was from her ladyship. He kept it, therefore, as a testimony against her, and finding himself in safety behind the angle of the trench, he began to question the wounded man. The latter confessed that he had been engaged with his comrade, the same who had now been killed, to carry off a young woman who was to leave Paris by the barrier of La Villette, but that, having stopped drinking at a wine shop, they had been 10 minutes too late for the carriage. "But what were you to have done with this woman?" demanded D'Artagnan, in an agony of doubt.
"We were to have taken her to an hotel in the Place Royale," said the wounded man.
"Yes, yes," muttered D'Artagnan. "That is it, to her ladyship herself." The young man shuddered as he comprehended with how terrible a thirst for vengeance this woman was impelled to destroy him and those who loved him, and how well she was acquainted with the secrets of the court, since she had detected even this. For this exact information she was indebted to the cardinal. But, as some degree of compensation, he ascertained with unfeigned joy that the queen had at last discovered the prison to which Madame Bonacieux had been sent to expiate her devotion, and had already rescued her from it. Thus the letter, which he had received from the young woman, and her appearance in the carriage on the Chaillot road, were explained to him. Thenceforth, as Athos had predicted, it was possible to find Madame Bonacieux again, and a convent was not impregnable. This idea disposed his heart to clemency. He turned towards the wounded man, who watched all the changes of his countenance with anxiety, and stretching out his arm to him, "Come," said he, "I will not leave you here. Rest on me, and let us return to the camp."
"Yes," said the wounded man, who could hardly credit so much magnanimity. "But is it not to have me hanged?"
"You have my word," replied he. "For the second time, I grant you your life." The wounded man fell on his knees and kissed the feet of his preserver. But D'Artagnan, who had no longer any motive for remaining so near the enemy himself, cut short these displays of gratitude. The guard, who had returned at the first discharge from the bastion, had announced the death of his four companions. There was, therefore, both great astonishment and great joy in the regiment when they saw the young man returning safe and sound. D'Artagnan explained the sword wound of his companion by a sortie which he invented. He recounted the death of the other soldier and the perils they had run. This account was the occasion of a veritable triumph to him. For one day the whole army spoke of this expedition, and His Royal Highness himself sent to compliment him on his conduct. And lastly, as every good action brings its recompense with it, that of D'Artagnan had the happy result of restoring to him the tranquillity that he had lost. In fact, the young man thought that he might cease to be disturbed, since, of his two enemies, one was killed and the other devoted to his interests. This tranquillity, however, proved one thing, that D'Artagnan did not yet thoroughly estimate her ladyship. 42. The Wine of Anjou. After almost hopeless accounts of the king, the report of his recovery began to spread through the camp, and as he was in great haste to be at the siege in person, it was said that he would set out as soon as he could mount his horse. In the meantime, His Royal Highness, who knew that he should soon be superseded, either by the Duc d'Angoulême, or by Bassompierre, or by Schomberg, who were already disputing with one another for the command, did but little, lost his time in petty attacks, and dared not hazard any great enterprise to drive the English from the Isle of Ré, where they besieged the citadel of Saint-Martin and the fort of La Prée, whilst the French, on their side, were besieging La Rochelle. D'Artagnan, as we have said, had become now easy in his mind, as always happens after a past danger, and when peril seems to have entirely vanished. Yet one anxiety still remained to him, which was that he received no tidings of his friends. But one morning he received an explanation in the following letter addressed from Villeroy. "Monsieur D'Artagnan, Messrs. Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, after having had a capital dinner party at my house, and enjoyed themselves very much, made so great a noise that the provost of the castle, who is a strict disciplinarian, put them in confinement for a few days. I must, nevertheless, execute the orders that they gave me, to send you 12 bottles of my Anjou wine, which they greatly admired. They hope that you will drink to their healths in their own favourite wine. I have done this, and am, sir, with great respect, your most obedient, humble servant, Godot, the host of Messieurs the Musketeers."
"Good!" exclaimed D'Artagnan.
They think of me amidst their pleasures, as I have thought of them in my weariness. Certainly I will drink to them, and with all my heart, too, but not alone." And D'Artagnan hastened to the quarters of two guards, with whom he had become more intimate than with any of the others, to invite them to come and drink some of the delicious wine of Anjou, which had just arrived from Villeroy. One of the two guards was to be on duty in the evening, and the other on the morrow, so the appointment was made for the day after. D'Artagnan sent his 12 bottles of wine to the mess-room of the guards, desiring to have it kept with care, and on the day of the entertainment, as the dinner was fixed for 12 o'clock, he sent Planchet at 9 to get everything prepared. Planchet, elated at this exaltation to the dignity of butler, determined to perform his duties like an intelligent man. To effect this, he called in the aid of the valet, named Fourneau, of one of his master's guests, and also that of the pretended soldier who had sought to slay our hero, and who, belonging to no regiment, had, since the Gascon spared his life, entered into D'Artagnan's service, or rather, into Planchet's. The appointed dinner hour being come, the two guests arrived and took their places, and the dishes were arranged upon the table. Planchet waited with a napkin on his arm. Fourneau uncorked the bottles, and Brisemont, for that was the invalid's name, decanted the wine, which seemed to have been somewhat disturbed by the shaking of the journey. The first bottle being a little thick towards the bottom, Brisemont poured the lees into a wine-glass, and D'Artagnan permitted him to drink it, for the poor wretch was still very weak. The guests, having finished their soup, were just conveying the first glass of wine to their lips, when suddenly the cannon sounded from Fort Louis and Pont-Neuf. The guards, thinking that there was some unexpected attack, either from the garrison or from the English, immediately seized their swords. D'Artagnan did the same, and the three hastened out towards their posts. But scarcely were they out of the mess-room before they found the reason of this great noise. Cries of "Long live the King! Long live the Cardinal!" re-echoed on every side, and drums were beat in all directions. In fact, the King, in his impatience, had made such forced marches that he had at that moment arrived with a reinforcement of 10,000 men. His musketeers preceded and followed him. D'Artagnan, placed in line with his company, with an expressive gesture saluted his friends and Monsieur de Treville, whom he at once recognized. The ceremony of reception being ended, the four friends were soon united.
"Egad!" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "You could not have arrived in better time. The dinner will not have had even time to get cold. Is it not so, gentlemen?" added the young man, turning to the two guards, whom he presented to his friends.
"Ah! Ah!" said Porthos. "It appears that you were feasting."
"I hope," said Aramis, "that there are no ladies at your dinner."
"Is there any wine that is drinkable in this paltry place?" said Athos.
"Why, sang Dieu, there is your own, my dear friend," answered D'Artagnan.
"Our wine?" said Athos, in astonishment.
"Yes, that which you sent me."
"Wine that we sent you?"
"Yes, you know very well, that wine from the hills of Anjou."
"Yes, I know what wine you are talking of,
your favorite wine."
"Aye, when I have neither champagne nor Chambertin."
"Well, in the absence of champagne and Chambertin, you must be contented with this."
"And so we, gluttons as we are, have sent you some wine, have we?" said Porthos.
"No, but it is the wine which was sent by your orders."
"By our orders?" echoed the musketeers.
"Did you send the wine, Aramis?" inquired Athos.
"No."
"Did you, Porthos?"
"No." "Did you, Athos?"
"No."
"If it was not you," said D'Artagnan, "then it was your host."
"Our host?"
"Yes, your host, Godot at Villeroy."
"Faith, let it come from whom it may, no matter," said Porthos. "Let us taste it, and if good, let us drink it."
"No," said Athos. "Let us not drink any wine without knowing whence it comes."
"You are right, Athos," said D'Artagnan. "Did none of you direct the host, Godot, to send me the wine?"
"No, and yet he sent you some in our names."
"Here is the letter," said D'Artagnan, and he presented the letter to his companions.
"It is not his writing," said Athos. "I know his hand, for it was I who, before we left, settled our joint account."
"A false letter," said Porthos indignantly. "We have not been imprisoned."
"D'Artagnan," said Aramis in a tone of reproach, "how could you believe that we had become noisy?"
D'Artagnan grew suddenly pale, and a convulsive trembling shook his limbs.
"You frighten me," said Athos. "What can have occurred?"
"Let us run, my friends, let us run," said D'Artagnan. "A horrible suspicion crosses my mind. Can this, too, be another of that woman's acts of vengeance?"
It was now Athos who, in his turn, grew pale. D'Artagnan sprang towards the mess room, followed by the three musketeers and